Chen Rob McGregor welcome you to a place where all kinds of phenomena flourish. Voices whisper, ancient secrets, signs and symbols are abundant. UFOs, ETs, ghosts, and even the dead move about freely. Here we meet authors, researchers, and investigators of the mysterious, the strange, and of the inexplicable anomalies that surround us. Step out of the everyday world and take a journey into the mystical underground.
Welcome to the Mystical Underground. Thank you for joining us. This is Trish McGregor and
Rob McGregor.
And our producer and tech magician, John Posey. You can go to themysticalunderground.com where we make regular blog posts where you can find out about our books. Among them are Phenomena, Harnessing Your Psychic Abilities, The Secrets of Spirit Communication, Sensing the Future, and Aliens in the Backyard. Our latest book is called Mind-Blowing Synchronicities, the latest science stories and research. Trish's latest novel is White Crows, and Rob's is called Tulpas. If you're watching us on YouTube, we would appreciate it if you take a second to click the like, subscribe, and notification buttons so you never miss an episode. If you prefer to listen to the show, it's available wherever you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe there.
Okay, our guest today is Lloyd Auerbach, who is world-recognized paranormal authority and parapsychologist with a graduate degree in parapsychology, and he has made thousands of media appearances. Lloyd is the author or co-author of 9 books on the paranormal, including the second edition of the Paranormal Casebook, which is out now, as well as Psychic Dreaming, ESP Wars East and West, and ESP Hauntings and Poltergeists. He has also co-authored 2 paranormal mysteries. He is the director of the Office of Paranormal Investigations, founded in 1989. He's on the faculty of Atlantic University, and he's president of the board of directors of the Orion Research Center, where he teaches online parapsychology, which he's going to do, I think, right after our podcast today. And courses at the Orion Education Center. Besides all that, he is a professional mentalist and past president of the Psychic Entertainers Association. Welcome, Lloyd.
Good
Thank
to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here, Robin, Trish.
Yeah, great to meet you.
I like finally. Your books back here.
thank you. Thank you.
That's great.
I should have pulled, I actually have a few of Rob's books in my paperback collection in the closet, next to Martin Caden's books, in fact. So
that's funny.
Right, we'll have to talk about Marty. Okay, so after 45 years in the field, are people more accepting of parapsychology and the paranormal now than in the past when you started? Do you think there's a difference in attitude or acceptance?
Well, I think people are talking about it more. The general public is talking about it more in different ways than they did when I got started.
How about scientists?
In the 70s, scientists were pretty open to this. Academia was open to this. 60s and 70s, there were. I worked at the American Society for Psychical Research in the early 80s in the education department. And we had a list of over 100 colleges that had at least one parapsychology. Today, you might find a couple. There's fortunately a new degree program that got started at the California Institute for Human Science, but it because of the organized skeptics movement that started in the 70s, academia became toxic.
Yeah,
that's a shame.
Yeah.
Well, tell us about your paranormal books, these 2 paranormal mysteries. You co-authored.
So my 2 buddies, Rich Hosek and Arnold Rudnick, who were actually they were television writers. They had written for television. I met Arnold back in the 90s and for something else, and we ended up becoming really good friends. And then I met Rich, and we came up with an idea for a TV series.
Oh, cool.
Which became known as Rainy and Day. We got it very, very close to selling it a couple times, scripted series based on a cop was a near-death experience and is a bit of a skeptic even after the experience, and a parapsychologist / anthropologist who he connects with through various reasons. And after so many years, we just decided, let's pull it out and turn them into novels. So we had already had like a show Bible with some basic storylines. We had the first, the two books, well, the first one's called Near Death. The second one is called Afterlife. And they're loosely based on material from my career, from parapsychology in general. And each of the books has a nice afterword explaining the reality of the psychic phenomena that is somewhat exaggerated in the books a little bit. So we've got a third one in the hopper right now called Farsight, which is based on remote viewing.
Okay.
Cool. So, now, are these on Amazon?
They are on Amazon. Okay. They are available as Kindle, in paperback, and as audiobooks.
Okay.
And you're writing under your own name then, too?
Yeah. So it's Rich Hosek is the main writer, then Arnold, and then myself. Yeah. So definitely my own name on there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so what do you think about the parapsychology after 45 years yourself? are you, you know, you've done a lot of ghost investigations. Are you a skeptic yourself, or have you, what's your position?
Well, I mean, when people ask me after being a skeptic myself, looking at the true definition of skeptic, I call myself a situational skeptic. I don't dismiss things out of turn. Mm-hmm. But I approach each case or each circumstance with a bit of let's see what it is, kind of like what's the evidence on either side for that. Because so much of what gets reported to us, even stuff that I investigate, often has normal explanations. And we have to eliminate the normal before we can actually study the paranormal, so to speak, the psychic side of things.
Did Marty Caden have a normal experience? A normal explanation. I observed that too. I was with Rob.
Yeah, I mean, Martin Caden blew me away totally.
Yeah.
When I saw him do his PK, you know, the targets. Because I actually set the targets up, so I volunteered.
Okay.
To look at it. Wow. Set them up and all that.
And the room was sealed.
It was not the first time. Was not in a sealed situation. It was actually under an aquarium tank. We're a large group at University of Nebraska for a Fortean conference. Uh-huh. And then I went out. I did go to Florida. I did go when he was living in Gainesville and sat with him outside that sealed room. I again went in. I checked everything there. I actually told him when to make the move. So it was up to me to tell him when things should move, not up to him. Yeah. And I witnessed quite a bit. And then over time, over the next couple of years, I did visit Florida a number of times, brought in a couple other researchers.
Huh.
We spent a lot of time in the PK. And then we did workshops. So taught people. In fact, I still teach people based on what Marty taught me.
How to do PK?
About PK, yeah.
Wow. About it or how to do it?
How to do it, yeah. And
okay, I'm signing up.
It's about 50% of the people can do it. You know, it's also really interesting that what Marty came up on was something that others in our field, in my field, had actually figured out about the psychology of doing psychokinesis and how much that resembles the psychology of human performance and sports psychology in general.
Wow.
In fact, I had a bunch of conversations with people. My dad was a TV sports producer, so I did talk to professional athletes. I talked to sports psychology people at JFK University when I was on faculty there. And it really is an interesting thing in the case of doubt preventing you from doing something and disbelief, like seeing something move.
Yeah.
Especially if you think you did it or somebody tells you you are doing it, causes significant conflict in a person's head.
Yeah. Huh. So I think what I observed is that some of those little, what would you call those things that
he called them psi wheels or just simply targets.
Yeah, that were like pieces like aluminum wings that were set up and would circle around. But I noticed that some of them seemed to be going clockwise and others moving counterclockwise. Did you observe that?
I observed a whole bunch of different types of materials. The really interesting ones were the pinwheels, which start turning.
Right.
They were turning in opposite direction. It's really hard to make them go the opposite direction.
Yeah.
I also observed an aluminum pie tin, you know, the kind you get in the supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
And he had glued tinsel hanging down from these things. from the thing. Huh. And when it was turning, the tinsel was not trailing behind, which would absolutely be the case due to the airflow. Yeah. There is no way that that tinsel could stay stiff unless it was stiff, and it was definitely not. I checked.
Yeah.
So pretty something else was going on there. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So the situation where we observed, Marty, was that we had gone to a book signing in Gainesville. It was a bookstore in Gainesville where the owner was under attack because he had some so-called pornographic comics on sale. And so we were supporting the bookstore owner for First mm-hmm. Amendment rights. And so Marty was there, and there were like five other authors there. You know, I think if we sold one book a piece, that was amazing. You know, but you know, it was interesting, you know, having talks, but kind of Marty kind of ran the show, you know. I mean, that was Marty, right?
he was absolutely a larger than life character, I think.
Right. Yeah. And he invited everybody over to his house, you know, to see
his magic room.
Abilities, but Trish and I were the only ones that accepted and went, you know.
Weird. I mean, that was the Haldemans.
Yeah.
It was Joe and Jay.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And, you know, but you know, some science fiction writers are, you know, skeptical of
that. Oh, yeah. I've met a few that are very skeptical. In the meantime, it was Harry Stein who actually convinced him to even try to do this. So another science fiction writer.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah.
He's the one who challenged Marty to do it to begin with.
So did anybody ever set it up separately from Marty doing it at all? Did you do that?
Okay. Yeah. We did it we still did it at his place in a couple of places.
Yeah.
Although we also did it at the University of Nebraska. Marty and I went back and did a workshop, and it was really interesting to see that he talked people through it, and like one person out of the 102 got the target turning. And then he showed them, he did it himself, and we showed video, and all of a sudden 52 of the 102.
Wow.
And that's been my experience, is that, and Marty actually said this, which is, and it fits in with the psychology, that once you see someone do it, it becomes much easier, and it'll actually fall into place. And the other thing, you know, I've run a number of spoon bending parties as well over the years. The actual process of that, again, based on a bit of psychology in parapsychology, was created by an aerospace engineer named Jack Houck. He started doing them in the late 70s. And I've done a whole bunch of them. And it's really interesting to see what happens, especially when you get these spoons that are bending in ways that, from an engineering perspective, really can't happen, like bending over the bowl of a spoon, twisting very, very heavy items that would just not work in a shock, deformation, or in actual strength of that. I mean, there's still
we saw Uri Geller in a mall. You know, he was just standing there. Remember that, Rob? And he had his spoons. I mean, and we were up close, and it looked very real.
Well, you know, I got to say that I know Geller can do this for real, but I also know he's a magician. So
yeah.
I was going to ask you that if he's a mentalist as well.
Yeah, he has kind of admitted that over the years. And I know some of the best metal benders in the Psychic Entertainers Association. We have guys who can outdo Geller like right and left. And I had a conversation with one of them who told me, who was performing, I think he's still performing in Las Vegas, Alain New. And when he did his metal bending, he'd have all the silverware on a table as he's doing it for the audience, small audience. And he would often say that sometimes the audience are pointing at his spoons on the table or the utensils, and they're bending on their own. So he actually experienced real PK at the time he's doing his entertainment.
Now,
have you ever had any interaction with the Amazing Randy?
Yeah, unfortunately.
He he's no longer with us. But
he's no longer with us, yeah.
Yeah, but he lived in the same county in Broward County. And
I don't know if you're aware, but Marty, he wrote a letter to Marty challenging, and this is back when he had his $10,000 challenge. Marty showed me the letters.
Yeah.
And Marty accepted and sent back a letter saying, if I can't do it, I will pay you $10,000.
Oh, wow.
And the response from Randy was, oh, forget about it.
I knew you were going to say that. Yeah,
Randy obviously thought that Marty had some way to get past his, you know.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, we saw him, Rob? And he was a big, grumpy guy.
Oh, yeah.
Remember, as we go into the door, he's wow, wow.
He was at is in Fort Lauderdale at an archaeology museum. And I think, who is it? Jim Mosley was doing something there. Uh-huh. And Randy was there. And so when we were leaving, this is funny, when we were leaving, out to the parking lot, like a dark alley behind the building. And, you know, I just, in a very friendly way, said, Randy, we've been following your career. And he just freaked out. I mean, he got so paranoid. He grabbed all his stuff, jumped in his car, and pulled away like we were threatening him, you know?
I kind of know why. So he had parts of his career that he tried to hide from people, part of his life that he tried to hide from people.
Yeah. Well, and just disembodied voice of John just for a second. So for folks that aren't familiar, can you give some history to kind of tie this community together that you're describing? Because I think heard a lot of names that seem to be interconnected. Where did this? Yeah, how did
right,
these
yeah,
people,
yeah, this kind of an inside baseball talk. We should kind of open it. Yeah.
So people might not know Martin Caden's name these days, but you know his works because his work Cyborg became the $6 Million Man. He was technical advisor on the series and actually helped create the Bionic Woman. He also wrote a book called Marooned in the 60s, which became an Academy Award winning film in 68. Kind of predicted things with Apollo 13 to some extent. And also inspired the Russian cosmonauts to contact NASA to have the Apollo-Soyuz mission. That actually came out of that because of that book and that movie. But he was an aerospace kind of aviation expert. Pilot. He was a consultant to NASA, worked actually in media in the late 50s, early 60s as well. It was just around the space program for a very long time. And he wrote a whole bunch of books on the space program as well as aviation history.
Yeah, he had about 150 books or so that he wrote.
Yeah, yeah.
And, he was way ahead of his time.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
One of the things that was interesting, the day we met him that evening, we spent with him. He was asking me about Indiana Jones novels that I written. And I mentioned that I just finished the sixth one and I'm going to take a break now because, you know, I would have to write them every 4 months and 4 month deadlines. And the next day I would have to start on the next one because I'd have another 4 month deadline. And there was this was before the internet and there was a lot of research on these locations and the mystical aspects and artifacts. So like 2 weeks later, I get a call from Randy and he said, well, I'm taking over your series now.
Marty.
And taking over your series now. And that was so odd because, I don't know how he would do that. Because, you know, I guess he knew I was not doing him anymore. And maybe he had the right connections, but to me, you know, just to a writer coming in and contacting Bantam Books, say, hey, I want to do these Indiana Jones stories now, they wouldn't get anywhere. But apparently Marty did, and he did two of
those. You sure it was Bantam? Maybe he went to Lucas.
They're all Bantam published all those books.
Well, I'm pretty sure that Bantam published a bunch of his aviation history books too.
Yeah, so and maybe he had a contact with
him. I believe that
would be possible.
Yeah, I know Tor Books published a bunch of his science fiction later on, but I think Bantam actually published, was Bantam or Ballantyne published Cyborg? So,
yeah. I mean, I didn't have any problem with that. I was tired of writing those books. Seven.
Well, your books were great. I read every one of them. So,
thank you.
And some other stuff you've written too.
Yeah. Should
we say anything about Randy in case people don't know who he was? So Randy was the Lex Luthor of parapsychology. I think that's the best way to put it.
Yeah, that is good.
But he was an escape artist and magician. He latched onto Uri Geller in the 1970s and made it his basically made his career again by being the opposing voice to what was happening with Geller, with Uri Geller, the Israeli psychic. And he was involved in the start of the Committee for Scientific Investigation of Claims of the Paranormal. He was absolutely a denier of any of this in a very rude way quite often. I'll just say that from a personal experience. Went on to first offered a $10,000 prize, which often didn't exist when he said he had the check in his pocket. That's a different story. But he got some people through the Skeptics Organization to put up money for $1 million challenge. And for many, many years, that's what the skeptics were, you know, well, has anybody won the $1 million challenge to do something paranormal or psychic? I'd hear that all the time. That challenge stopped in 2015. They figured they had done enough. They're using the money for something else. Even though skeptics still bring it up when I'm lecturing or talking sometimes. And because it just like, what my response to that is, you know, first of all, the rules that he set up were, it was rigged. I can't say it's rigged. It was biased in his direction, whether you won or whether you lost. That was the problem. None of the good psychics that I knew, or attorneys who looked at the rules, were interested at all.
And that organization, PsyCops, they were over the top skeptics. I mean, they
deniers. Done a lot of damage.
Deniers, right?
They
weren't scientific.
No. Actually, even the ones who were scientists were not scientific, because they refused to look at any of the evidence or research for things. One of the founders, Marcello Truzzi, who was a sociologist at Eastern Michigan University, quit the organization within a year after finding out that the rest of the organization founders were totally biased against any of this stuff, whereas Marcello was curious, as a scientist should be, and ended up aligning himself with parapsychology and was became my mentor, one of my mentors, in fact.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He was a great guy. He actually got me into the Psychic Entertainers Association. So, you know, there are people who are truly skeptics, and Marcello coined the phrase or the term pseudo skeptics. Because they pretend to be skeptics, but they're not really skeptics.
I interviewed him briefly once. So we used to, in the 80s, we used to work for freelance for Omni magazine, and the red pages in the center there that had a section on paranormal and UFOs. And we would do these short little articles there.
That and because really of cool. that red section, we had to go to a UFO conference that was fascinating. Met Bud Hopkins and Betty Hill.
I got interviewed by a couple of other folks for that red section too, once in a while.
Oh, did you?
The black section, whatever section it was. Yeah.
It's the red section.
In the center.
Did the amazing Kreskin, was he involved in this community at all, or was that just
he's a mentalist.
So Kreskin was kind of standoffish even with other mentalists. He was not directly involved, but Marcello Truzzi knew him really well. In fact, I got to talk to Kreskin a couple times through Marcello, because of Marcello. And incredibly knowledgeable and very knowledgeable about the field and how much he really believed. I mean, one of the things about mentalists when you're performing compared to magicians. So if you're a magician on stage or performing for people, the trick's got to work. It has to work. I mean, it has to work. So if you are a mentalist, you know, ESP is not 100%. So if you don't get the right thing, it just shows that you're probably real. It's this really weird thing. So if something pops in your head during a show, it's whatever it happens to be, you can say it out loud. I'm getting something from somewhere and here's what it is. And inevitably, someone in the audience reacts to it. Whether that was ESP or dumb luck, hard to say. Sometimes it's pretty clear when it's ESP. And that's something that Kreskin took advantage of. And most of my buddies in the Psychic Entertainers take advantage of that too when that happens. So
where do you entertain?
These days, I haven't been doing much since the pandemic, unfortunately.
Yeah.
partly because I haven't had time to go out to market myself again. A lot of my colleagues in the psychic entertainers actually during the pandemic went to Zoom. They started doing Zoom shows, and I just didn't feel it because I like to have an actual audience in front of me on screen. But I've performed for private parties. I've performed for a couple of organizations here and there. It's generally been businesses, you know, like smaller businesses, a couple of corporations, and generally private party type stuff that I've done in the last few years anyway.
Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about your investigations of hauntings?
Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting ones that you've come across? And
well, you know, I started out, just to let you know, I started out in going into grad school with the idea that I was going to work in the lab.
Yeah.
And two things happened. One, one of the first courses I took was an investigations course, a spontaneous case investigations course. Mm-hmm. And the professor, the head of our department, sent us out on investigations that were coming into the university. So I found those fascinating, number one. And the second thing that happened is statistics. I don't like statistics. Very clear. So I kind of gravitated towards the human experience rather than the artificial human experience in the lab. Mm-hmm. I had a few ESP experiences here and there in college and after, but nothing really got me in the field because I was being psychic. Mm-hmm. Although I'd met a bunch of psychics and had some really interesting readings and such, and even seen a little PK while I was in college through a parapsychologist who was doing a workshop in Chicago. So when I started doing investigations, I again, approaching with a skeptical eye, what is really going on here? Over time, so a couple of really kind of cool investigations. One of my first ones that convinced me that we have survival of death, that consciousness survives the death of the body, was a case that happened in late 84 is when I first heard about it. I started doing it in 85. In the city of Livermore here was a family that had apparently individually been seeing this woman's ghost from the woman who used to live in the house. She did not die in the house. And something happened the day I got the call from the mother, who was an attorney. Her son, who was almost 13 years old at the time, said something about the ghost. And the mother said, "What ghost?" Even though she had seen the ghost. And he said, "You know, the ghost that you dad and grandma are seeing all the time but aren't talking about." And I said, "How do you know that?" "Lois told me." Lois was the ghost. So there was this kind of give and take. The mother wanted us to do an investigation, to talk to him, to see what was going on. Not because they were afraid, because they were not afraid. Because he was going to be a teenager and she was worried that he wouldn't grow up right. You know, fortunately, I didn't have to tell her later on that he got possessed, which is what happens with teenagers, but, you know, normally. Different kind of possession. Anyway, in the investigation, a few things happened. Number one, we got a huge amount of information about the woman's family history through the boy. He translated for us. He was kind of like acting like a medium in some respect, which I was able to confirm with her only living relative who lived in an assisted living facility, who the family had not been able to talk to. So I would start a family story. He would finish it. That was interesting. The other thing was during the session, I asked if she had any questions for us as investigators. The first thing that I heard was, and it was kind of part of this whole discussion, was, "Do you guys have blasters like on Ghostbusters?" Because apparently she watched TV with Chris, with the boy, and she saw her trailer for Ghostbusters, and he had seen her. All right. I was able to ask her, "Well, you know, what happened when you died?" And basically got this really interesting. She died in a hospital, terminal cancer. When she was closing her eyes, she had a kind of thought about her life. Her family was not religious. They were very social, well off. And she didn't know if there was a heaven or hell. So she just decided, "I just want to go home. You know, why take a chance?" And next thing she knew after closing her eyes was she was in the room, in her living room. And then I asked, "Well, you know, how is it that Chris sees you? And how come you have different clothing on every time he sees you?" And she said, "Well, it's how I think of myself. So my self-image is what Chris picks up on, or what other people pick up on," which fits in with stuff that we knew for 100 years, which is not in the typical literature.
How old was Chris when this was
close to 13.
Okay.
And then there are a couple other questions I asked that, again, he would have, at that time with publishing the way it was, he would have really had to dig to find out that some of us in the field or some people in the field felt this was what was going on with apparitions, with ghosts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Last thing was, Lloyd, do you really want to get a new car? Joanna, do you want to quit? Do you really want to quit your job? And Kip, how long were you a professional dancer when you were away between college and grad school? Now, those three questions related to a conversation the three of us had on the 40-minute drive from the university to Livermore.
Oh.
Unless they bugged my car. And there was no motivation. I mean, if they were going to sell this to the movies, I would have worried about that. But I said, how does Lois know to ask these questions? Or are you really psychic, Chris? He looks over at this empty chair and turns back and says, she didn't trust you guys about the blaster thing, so she got to the university and rode in the back seat of your car and listened in to your conversation.
Wow.
Wow.
And that just was like kind of totally blew my mind. And following up on that with the relative and everything else, that case just convinced me that at least sometimes people survive the death of their bodies.
You keep in touch with Chris?
No, I haven't talked to the family since 2004. So it's been quite a while.
20.
But over that time, in that 20 years, yeah, there was a lot of stuff that ghosts was still interacting and all that was still going on. That case I wrote up in a book called Surviving Death by Leslie Keane, K-E-A-N.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that's a good book.
Yeah, it's a really good book. So another case that I had was a case of a place which has still got some activity called the Banta Inn, which is in Tracy, California. And a friend of mine who was related to somebody at the place, who was also doing investigations with us, brought me there, and we had physical stuff happening. I mean, it was just like really interesting physical activity. In fact, one of the first visits, I was there with Hard Copy. I don't know if you remember that TV show from the
80s. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the director, this is 11 in the morning, director and the cameraman are facing me with their backs to the bar. The ghost, by the way, was the former bartender manager owner, died in the 60s. And the bartender and the current owner were down at the other end of the bar. And an ashtray, as I'm talking, an ashtray on the bar popped up in the air, flips over. It was a glass ashtray, smashes down in the bar, doesn't break. Obviously, they heard it. They didn't see it. Mm-hmm. The owner and the bartender started laughing. I was laughing, especially after the director said, what was that? And can you get him to do it again?
That's the truth.
A glass of orange juice started sliding across the bar like in an Abbott and Costello movie.
Oh.
And then there were a whole bunch of other things over a period of over a year that I would visit, and things were going on that were just not physically possible the way things were going on. So even sat with a director and his fiance and a cameraman on another shoot for dinner. And the salt shaker started going back and forth on the table. Again, like an Abbott and Costello movie.
Wow.
The guy had a real sense of humor, clearly. So
you need to go to Casadega, Lloyd. Do you know what it is?
I do know what Casadega is. I never, in all the trips I made to Florida, I never got a chance to go there.
The hotel there is haunted.
Yeah. It's
real.
It's kind of old world, too.
Yeah, it's old world spiritualism.
Yeah, that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know a bit about Casadega from a friend of mine who used to live in the area. And I actually work with mediums quite a bit through the Forever Family Foundation, especially, which I'm president of. So, and I've always, in investigations, I prefer to take a psychic or medium with me, mm-hmm. just as kind of a extra information check.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we stayed... Well, we've been up there a number of times, but when our daughter was young, we stayed in a hotel one night, and we were the only people there because it was bike week. Everybody had gone to Daytona. So about 11 o'clock at night, getting ready for bed, Megan's already asleep, and we hear this boom, 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 like somebody wearing boots coming up the stairs. And so I said, Rob, what is that?
And walking down the hallway.
Coming towards our room. And then I said, maybe we should get out of here. And so Rob says, no, let's pull the dresser in front of the door. So pull the dresser.
I mean, we're not, you know, we've had spirit contact before, but this was something different.
Yeah, this was not nice.
This was not human. I mean, this was the door handle jiggled, and there's just this feeling that do not open that door.
The door.
It was a very frightening experience. Was it all our imagination? I don't think so, because we heard this clumping sound.
Well, we saw the handle jiggle.
Right, yeah.
I'm worried more about a living person than a dead person, honestly. Yeah.
Well, I went down the next day and asked the person at the desk. I said, hey, there was a ghost coming to our room last night, jiggling the door. He goes, oh, they're all friendly. I said, this one was not. This was not a friendly ghost.
Yeah.
Well, it's the way we look at it, most of us in the field look at it is, ghosts are people too. So
yeah.
Real buttheads, let's put it that way.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but I think some entities are not of human nature.
I haven't run into anything like that before. I know people talk about that quite a bit.
Dark energy.
Yeah, I've had cases where I have to say that the entity, the apparition was dark, but they were looking at who they were when they were alive. They were like that when they were alive. So they were a bully or something else. And we have other ways we've been able to get to deal with that kind of thing. But, one of the things that I have learned over the years, and partly from Marty, I mean, he helped reinforce this, is that we're alive, we have more power. Uh-huh. It may not seem like we do, but we have natural protection for things like that. Mm-hmm. Now, if they start throwing a dresser around, that's a whole different story. Right, you have to be able to duck out of the way. But even those poltergeist cases where things are moving, people generally don't get hurt unless they are causing the activity themselves. They often self-direct in that way.
Yeah. Hmm. Where do you teach this PK course?
Well, when I do the workshops, they've been local here in the Bay Area, or I've done them at a couple of other organizations. The Ryan Research Center in Durham, North Carolina actually does occasional days where they do spoon bending type of stuff.
Oh, cool.
They call them Psy Games. They'll do them. I think now we're doing them probably every other month. They're doing them for people who want to sign up. I haven't done one in the Bay Area lately because I haven't found a good place to do them. But I've taught people, I can do the online thing also with the PK, the wheels. Teach people how to do that. I had a book out called Mind Over Matter, which has all the detailed instructions. It's got a section for Marty. I'm getting it back into print in the next few months. Llewellyn was publishing it, but they took it out of print last year. So I'm going to self-publish it this time around.
Good.
So I can keep it in print, but it'll hopefully by the end of the summer, I'll have that back out for that.
Llewellyn took a lot of books out of print. We lost our Secrets of Spirit Communication too.
Yeah. So the Ryan Research Center, that's not associated any longer with the University of North Carolina, right? Where
it was Duke University. So yeah, So this year is the 90th anniversary of the founding of the Duke Parapsychology Lab by J.B. and Larisa Ryan, 1935. When Ryan retired, because 65 years old, they made you retire in the 60s. He took the lab off campus. Actually, they moved right across the street from the campus to a location and created a foundation at that time. It was called the Foundation for Research on the Nature of Man and the Institute for Parapsychology. In the late 1980s, after he passed away, it was renamed the Ryan Research Center. So it is technically the only continuous parapsychology laboratory in the United States. For 90 years. And the Ryan is doing monthly lectures online with different people kind of celebrating. And then they'll be doing some kind of live things in person this fall, I believe, as well in Durham.
So you're in San Francisco.
Still a stone's throw from Duke. So, excuse me?
You're in San Francisco.
I'm outside of San Francisco, right.
Outside,
yeah. Okay. So I get there usually once a year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, unless they decide to fly me there or something else.
What about your book, The Paranormal Casebook?
So the two cases I talked, one of the two cases I talked about, the Banta Inn, that one bar, that is in A Paranormal Casebook. So that's a book I wrote a number of years ago. I brought it back into print last year with some updating on some of the material about apparitions and ghosts, ghosts and things like that. I was going to add some cases to it. It's actually got two things involving Martin Caden. One of them is an investigation we did at Ashley's Pub in Florida near Cocoa Beach, very haunted place that Marty took me to that he had investigated since the 1960s. And then the other is a story about my experience with him after he died.
Oh, really?
Why?
Yeah.
Okay, so, I'll get the book.
Yeah, I had an experience that was confirmed by someone, one of his pilot buddies, who had the same experience 10 minutes before me in New Jersey.
How? What happened?
It turned out that they were, according to him, later on to his friend Bob, who followed up with a bunch of other people, something like 25 of us had the same experience, either in a plane alone, flying a plane or driving a car, a sudden sense of presence and smell of stinky cigar smoke.
Jeez.
Yeah. I think I heard this story from somebody else. I can't remember. There were multiple people.
It was really interesting that so many of us had this experience.
And you were all separate.
All separate within a couple of days and, not talking to each other about it, after the fact kind of
thing.
That's
fascinating.
I also have a little kind of a very short thing that Marty checked out when Deke Slayton died, the astronaut, mission control.
Right.
And when he died in Texas at somewhere like 3 a.m. Texas time. That morning, a little bit later that morning, a racing plane with specific registration number, I think it was NX01, a particular type, particular color, was cited for a noise violation for making too much noise. It was a racing plane that would make a lot of noise. And this was at Orange County Airport. So Bobby Slayton, Deke's wife, about a month later, gets this citation letter forwarded from another address citing Deke for a noise violation. And the timing of the noise violation was several hours after he died. And the plane itself was in an aircraft museum in Sparks, Nevada, with the engine sitting on the side of the aircraft.
Oh, jeez.
The tower saw the plane take off. They saw the plane, heard the plane, saw it take off on its own and fly into the sunrise, and then disappear off radar.
Wow.
So
they
identified it. So it would be a bizarre, nobody at that time knew that Deke had died. Just the doctor, their daughter, and Bobby. That's it. So the idea that somebody coincidentally had made a mock-up of Deke's plane.
No.
Decided to fly it that day.
There are no coincidences.
Yeah, I mean, that's more unbelievable than there was a ghost plane.
Yeah.
But that was stuff around Marty. There was always crazy stuff going on.
Yeah. Speaking of coincidences or meaningful coincidences, synchronicities, do you have many happening to you in your investigations?
Well, I can say that I'm in the field because of really bizarre timing.
Okay.
Like the universe, weird things happen for me. I got interested in parapsychology as a teenager. Started a parapsychology club in high school thanks to a couple of teachers, an earth science teacher and a physics teacher were both interested. And I was walking up the street past a neighbor's house, and my brother Ron, his best friend, lived there. And Arthur's mother was outside, and she comes over to me. She says, "Lloyd, I know you started a parapsychology club." I knew she was a yoga teacher. One of my students is Montague Ullman, who at that time was doing research at Maimonides Dream Center on Dream Center,
yeah. Oh, right. Wow.
He lived about a mile and a half. So she set me up to talk to Ullman, who then set me up to talk to Gertrude Schmeidler, who lives in the next town down.
Yeah.
So another synchronicity.
Psychology. I had them talk to our club. I go to college. I actually went to Northwestern with the intention originally studying astrophysics, and Jalen Hynek was the head of the department. So I got to spend time with Hynek. I actually volunteered at the Center for UFO Studies. That was not a coincidence. I chose that. But I realized, again, the math got me, unfortunately. And I realized that I wanted to do something else. So I switched into anthropology, cultural anthropology. And when I was assigned an advisor, I go into his office. He's out at the restroom. I'm looking around his office. He has the Journal of Parapsychology on his shelf.
Oh, wow.
What are the odds of that?
Yeah.
So I was laughing about that. I had some great professors. Took this course, this mini course at Mundelein College in my senior year in Chicago on parapsychology. It was a 6-week course taught by a couple of parapsychologists. And I figured I was going to take a year off from between college and grad school because I didn't know where to go at that time since there was nobody that had parapsychology. Mm-hmm. I was trying to figure out what psychology department I wanted to go to and then see if I could specialize or something. So Ramakrishna Rao was guest lecturing from the Rhine. It was actually the Institute for Parapsychology at the time. And I started talking to him. He said, well, you're in luck. They just started a graduate parapsychology program at John F. Kennedy University in California this year. So I go there. I come back from graduating there, and I had some ideas for promoting the American Society for Psychical Research. And I was a member. I wanted to use the library. I was talking to the head of the education department about some ideas for them. And my father, being in television, had an uncle in radio. I had some media ideas for them. And the woman says to me, well, you know, we have a new executive director. I'm going to have you go upstairs and talk to him. He'll probably want to hear your ideas. So I go upstairs and, you know, he happened to be in town because he didn't live in New York. He says, you want a job?
Wow.
I had one thing after another happen, you know, made me a lot of money in parapsychology, but
yeah.
One thing after another, those kinds of events have kept me. I mean, Ghostbusters was good for me, especially given that when the Oakland Tribune wanted to do a major article on the only parapsychology program in the United States, I was the only one in town because I couldn't afford to go to the Parapsychological Association convention in Texas. So it ends up being a 2-page spread about me and the program.
That's great.
Which was picked up by the Associated Press, which ran in over 500 newspapers. I mean, that kind of got me my book contract.
Uh-huh.
Right. Great.
So, yeah. So synchronicities, I guess you could say.
You're on your path.
There's nothing. Yeah. I can't get
they
away.
They come to you. Yeah. They come to you when you're on your path. Yeah. So
that's great.
How did you get involved with Fate Magazine? I remember you used to have a column.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. We did some freelancing for Fate.
So Scott Rogo was a parapsychologist writing a column. Martin Eben was writing this column, Psychic Frontiers, for many years. Mm-hmm. He was still an editor for Fate. And I didn't know him at all. But Scott Rogo took it over and did a phenomenal job on that column. When he was murdered, they had Martin took it back for a bit. And I actually got a call from him. He had read ESP Hauntings and Poltergeists and thought that I would be a good person to take over the column. So he was the one who actually brought me into Fate to do that column.
I didn't know Rogo was murdered.
Oh, yeah. He was murdered. Yeah. In 1990. Yeah.
Did they ever find who did it?
Yeah, they eventually did. There was a psychic tip that had something to do with it. But it was a real shame. I mean, Scott was encyclopedic in knowledge on many, many levels.
Great. I loved his column.
Yeah.
He wrote one book that was about psychic contact through the telephone. Phone calls from the dead. Right?
Yeah, he wrote that with Raymond Bayless. There's a new Callum Cooper, who is over in the UK and connected the Society for Psychical Research. He wrote a book called Telephone Calls from the Dead, and that just went into its second edition recently.
Yeah,
that's available on Amazon.
The skeptics really had. Ball with the phone calls from the dead.
It's interesting who they decide to target at any given time. The things are, you know, Randy targeted me after I had done him a favor, which was really bizarre. So, you know, somebody talked me into doing something. He was being sued and I provided some information and was willing to testify. Given the circumstances were not, that were definitely not him. It was not his fault. Let's put it that way for the situation. Yeah. And his attorney apparently used some of the information I provided. It was about a girl who had done a TV special in Japan and was able to read like sealed messages. And Randy called her a phony and talked about how she did it. And the family was suing him for loss of future income. And then in my conversation, I was talked into conversing with Randy about this and by Ray Hyman. And I said, okay, that, you know, that's a ridiculous lawsuit. Honestly, it's a ridiculous lawsuit. Yeah. I realized when Randy was telling me what happened, it took her 6 hours to read one message. And I said to him, forget about future income. Who is going to hire this girl to do this if she can't do it immediately?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's not future income. That is future annoyance.
Now, have you ever worked with Joe McMonagle?
Yeah, I know Joe pretty well. I haven't worked with him directly, except see, he is on the board of the Ryan Research Center, and he works quite a bit with my buddy Ed May. I mean, Joe was part of the book ESP Wars, East and West. So I work with him, you know, work with him and Ed and Victor Rubel on that particular book. Yeah, Joe's a great guy.
He is.
We went to Eleuthera with him and his wife.
I
got hit by a hurricane.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was only one road out of there, and it was under 6 feet of water. And some guy from, where was he? A Swedish guy came by with a truck that had enormous, like, tractor wheels on. So we had to climb up a ladder to get into this truck to get out of there and get to the airport to get out of there. And there was only one runway open. The entire airport was surrounded by water, but we managed to leave, but that's it's kind of an interesting experience. But the problem is, though, Joe did not want to believe that there was going to be a hurricane hit. He wanted to have a good week.
It doesn't matter how psychic you are.
Yeah, right.
If you're biased towards having a good time,
yes. Yeah,
right. And Tricia's really arguing. There's going to be.
I kept telling him, no, it's coming, it's coming. I've been studying these things.
living in the path of hurricanes every summer.
Well, you know, weather prediction is as good as psychic predictions.
Yeah, right.
Right.
Yeah. He and Rob had to go down to the ocean every morning to collect seawater to flush the toilet.
Oh, no. Wow.
Well, it was bad.
It's bad.
I'd wade out to my knees, and then a wave would break over my head as I'm holding the bucket. Yeah, that was fun. Okay. I wanted to ask you about the Office of Paranormal Investigations. Is that real? I mean, what is that?
Well, it's something that back during the graduate parapsychology days at JFK University, JFK University has been subsumed. It's been bought by and absorbed by National University these days. Our parapsychology program ended around 1987, and we were still getting calls for investigations. So a friend and I started the Office of Paranormal Investigations with grad students and former students at JFK to cover cases that were coming in. Over time, so it's never had a physical office space. We were thinking we were going to at some point, which is why I called it the Office of Paranormal Investigations. But it's more of a network. And working actually with one of my Ryan students on a new website, which is pulling together, again, trained people who've been trained by me or others, so we can actually have a place for people to find reputable, knowledgeable investigators instead of the flashy ghost hunters that put up sites and make all sorts of claims. The flashy ghost hunters are still going to get a lot of the cases to start with because they're flashy and they make promises or statements that I don't even want to say exaggerated. They're just simply out and out fabric, you know, they're hallucinations. Let's put it that way. Like, since we can talk about AI, they're like hallucinations.
Yeah. You know? So what about all this equipment they use, the electronics? What do you think about
There's some good equipment, but it doesn't do what they often hope it does. An EMF meter reads electromagnetic fields. It does not tell you that there's a ghost present or that there's something psychic going on. So the whole idea of them using equipment comes from television. And before that came from my field where researchers wanted to see what was going on in the physical environment when someone has an experience and when they don't. So is there a change in the environment when somebody sees, has an experience with a ghost or a haunting or poltergeist activity? Is there physical change in the environment? And can we correlate those changes so that we might be able to predict something else? What else could cause those changes that might be actually causing someone to have an experience that is not paranormal? I mean, those are all things that we had the question. That's how we use the equipment even to this day. But television wanted, even as far back as when I started doing TV shows, segments on ghost hunting and things back in the 80s, they were always asking me, do you have anything that make that lights up, that makes noise?
Anything suitable for TV.
It's a visual medium. They wanted more than talking heads or, you know, stakeouts or things like that.
Yeah.
Since they can't get a ghost on camera. And the answer was no. Eventually did have handheld, you know, inexpensive EMF meters, and we started doing correlation. And there are some correlations, but not to ghostly stuff, to some other things that are going on in the environment. Temperature, there are, people talk about cold spots. When you use a thermometer, there are no cold spots. People feel cold, but the physical environment doesn't get colder than the spot 2 feet away from that.
Huh.
Unless there's a physical explanation for it. So we are using it to figure out in the environment what's going on, whereas on TV, they're using it to detect the paranormal.
Uh-huh.
And anything weird, they exaggerate or react to. And part of that is the directors that are on site who are telling them to react that way. I don't know that a lot of these folks, if they got a high, you know, suddenly got a big swing of the EMF meter, whether they'd start freaking out or just, you know, at all. But, you know, they'll start running or something else if they hear something. It's all drama. I mean, those shows don't resemble, I mean, they resemble reality, but they are not reality.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
What are you working on now? What type of investigations?
It's been pretty quiet, actually. I did one investigation of a famous haunted site, the Whaley House Museum in San Diego, with a friend of mine brought me down. Actually, he rented the place out from 11 to 3 at night.
Oh, wow.
Hours with a docent. The folks who owned the place were shocked that we wanted to keep the lights on because, you know, you don't need darkness. That's a TV thing. It's totally a TV thing. We didn't have a lot of activity till like very, very end. We had some, I did have a medium with me. She did pick up on things, but experiences that I had or that Tom had, we didn't really have that happening, but we did have some really interesting things from two different types of equipment kind of in tandem that should not have happened at the time the medium was actually experiencing something. So we at least have some correlation there. She told us that, they're still wondering who you are and what you're doing and, you know, why you're so different than everybody else who comes in these investigations here.
Yeah, it's interesting.
That's what happens, you know.
I got to
have them warm up to me, typically.
Yeah, that's funny. You got to go to the Casadega Hotel, I'm telling you.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of places I'd like to go to. It's there's a limited budget. There's not really
food
and that sort of thing, unfortunately. So one of these days I'll get back out in that direction.
We went there with Whitley Strieber and Peter Lavenda. You ever heard of him, Peter Lavenda?
Name sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah, he's kind of a dark entity. He's written a lot of books. And look him up, Peter Lavenda.
Okay.
So just to give you a clue about him, so Whitley got readings. Trish and I got readings. I said, Peter, why don't you get a reading? He said, well, if I get a reading, I'd have to kill the reader.
Yeah.
Because the reader would know too much.
I wouldn't want to be that psychic reader.
Yeah.
You know, when I perform mentalism, people are always worried I'm going to, you know, for mentalists, that we're going to actually read people's minds. My line is, don't worry about it. I'm going to set up situations with very definitive things. I'm not going to dive deep into your head because I'll either get too interested or too grossed out.
Well, and we need to let Lloyd go. And
okay,
but real quick, you mentioned Ghostbusters earlier. So which one are you? Are you a Peter, a Ray, an Egon, or a Winston?
I have been told very clearly since the beginning of that movie, the first time, that I am Venkman.
You're a Venkman. Okay.
I am Venkman. All right. Yeah. But I've never been slimed.
All right. Yeah. Now tell people where they can find you and et cetera. Sure.
So I do have a website. It's LloydAuerbach.com. Pretty simple. You can see my name there. So one L. Also, I do have a Facebook page. It's Lloyd.Auerbach.author on Facebook. I do an every other week Ask Professor Paranormal. That's what I'm known as. And I do them. The next couple will be June 1st and June 15th and June 29th.
Oh, okay.
That is on YouTube. It is youtube.com/@AskProfessorParanormal.
Okay.
Okay.
Great.
Well, thank you. This was fascinating.
Yeah, it was great. Fun. Thanks for coming out.
Anytime.
We'll send you the link when John puts it up.
Yeah, have a good night.
All right.
Take care. Thank you.
Thanks for joining The Mystical Underground. Visit www.themysticalunderground.com for the latest blog post and book info. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app. Listen to the podcast at podcast.themysticalunderground.com. Follow Trish and Rob on Instagram at Trish and Rob McGregor. Follow us on Twitter at The Mystic Cast. Send email to podcast@themysticalunderground.com. And until next week, thank you for listening and stay mystical. We'll be right back.